Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to restore momentum after a setback, particularly one that requires you to change direction? Obstacles can be discouraging, but they can also be viewed as opportunities for growth. And according to Stoic philosophy, chances to practice virtues like patience, humility, or creativity. And whether they did so intentionally or not, my guest has realized that many well-known luminaries in history have embraced elements of the Stoic ideals outlined by Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius in the 2nd century. And he believes if they were helpful to the likes of Abraham Lincoln, Amelia Earhart, and Arthur Ashe, these ideas could be useful to us as well. Ryan Holiday is editor-at-large for the New York Observer and author of the new book, The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph. Ryan, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So under what circumstances did Marcus Aurelius begin to write out his philosophy on coping with impediments?
I imagine it was shortly after being introduced to Stoic philosophy. The idea of sort of writing daily practices or reminders or these Stoic exercises is very much a part of the philosophy. And what I think is so unique about someone like Marcus Aurelius, he was the most powerful man in the world, right? He's the emperor of Rome. And yet he was introduced to Stoicism early on in his life through the works of Epictetus, who was a slave in Rome. So you have, you know, someone facing extreme adversity influencing someone who's about to experience extreme success. And then I think that collective wisdom survives to us through their writings, and you're seeing it today. All sorts of people are reading it and applying it in their own lives.
How did you come to this in the first place, and can you talk about sort of what sort of revelations you found the first time that you started reading Stoic philosophy?
Yeah, I guess my experience wasn't all that different. As most people, someone saw I was going through something while I was in college. I was, you know, a young kid. I had certain ambitions, but I was, you know, I was just struggling with the stresses of that life. I think I'd gone through a breakup. And I actually met the author and radio host Dr. Drew at an event, and I said, "Hey, what book should I read?" And he handed me the lectures of Epictetus, and that sort of it was this quake moment for me. It sort of opened my eyes to a different way of thinking about my problems, about life. Obviously, at 19 years old, when I read this, I didn't fully understand it. But as I've, you know, been successful in business and successful as a writer, these words have, you know, repeatedly come back to me over and over and over again. And I saw Stoicism as this thread through history that was guiding people in difficult times, not just to sort of muddle through their problems, but to actually, like, triumph because of them or be better off than if that problem had never happened at all.
So to the extent, Ryan, that people throw the term Stoicism around these days, it tends to get used to describe people who simply bear suffering without complaint. But the idea is not simply suffering for its own sake, right?
No, absolutely not. Both Stoicism and Epicureanism have sort of been reduced to these caricatures of themselves. But, you know, the quote that my book is based on comes, you know, directly from Marcus Aurelius, and he says, you know, the impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way. And it's this, to me, it's this formula, not for pessimism as Stoicism is characterized as, but as optimism. He's saying, like, look, stuff happens to you, and you don't control what that stuff is. But you do control how you respond. And that is the core of Stoicism, which is that we live in an unpredictable, even occasionally capricious world, but we control our own selves in that world. We control our emotions, we control our thoughts, and we control our actions, you know, for the most part. And the Stoics say, you know, if you can make those actions guided by reason and virtue and logic, you are going to be able to see them for what they actually are rather than reacting in a way that makes things worse.
Stoics are deeply pragmatic, though, and part of that pragmatism comes in the form of anticipating the fact that there may, in fact, be obstacles.
Yes, right. I you know, in business circles, they have this concept of doing a pre-mortem, right, mm-hmm. which is a way, instead of a post-mortem, which, you know, the doctor does after the surgery has gone wrong, they say, how could this go wrong in advance, and how can we anticipate that? How can we gird ourselves for a world where things do in fact go wrong? And, you know, the Stoics had a concept of meditatio malorum, which is the same idea, which is sort of a premeditation of evils. What are the things that could potentially get in our way? There's a sort of a Zen saying of this. It's like, the cup is already broken. So you have this prized piece of china. If you remind yourself that it's already going to break, when it does break, it does not come as this unpleasant surprise and you are not crushed by it.
So let's talk about emotions and how dealing with emotion relates to Stoicism. I suppose part of the concern is that we can get distracted if we give in to every strong emotion we feel.
Yes, and I think that's a much more fair characterization than you often see, which is the idea that Stoics are devoid of emotion, mm-hmm. and that's not what it is at all. What the Stoic sort of ideal state is one of apatheia, which is not being ruled by your passions, good and bad. And obviously they have a different definition of passions. They mean like, you know, strong emotions, urges, temptations, things like that. So it's not being jerked to highs and jerked to lows, but keeping that sort of even keel. You know, the Stoics talk a lot about indifference also, indifference to external events. So, you know, one day you're named emperor, the next day you're exiled. These are sort of realities of Roman life that I think we tend to forget when, you know, as we live in a much more meritocratic society, we tend to overestimate the agency that we have in the world and the power that we have over the world. And I think when you look back to the Stoics, you see this sort of a more refreshing humility that says, like, look, I don't control everything around me, and things are going to happen that I don't want to happen.
Easier said than done, though, right? To control your emotions. Any ideas for how to accomplish that beyond practice?
Yeah, well, look, the lesson that I take from all of that, when I read, you know, Marcus Aurelius or Seneca or Epictetus, who are these wise, successful men, and I see them reminding themselves about controlling their emotions, you have to realize they were not writing to you, the reader, like preaching to you. Most often, they were writing to themselves, likely because they did the opposite of that thing. Mm. So Stoicism is this series of exercises where you're reminding yourself, like, hey, I freaked out about what happened. I shouldn't do that. Here's why. And so this idea of journaling, I think, is very important. This idea of, you know, putting a pause between, you know, feeling and action. I think the Stoics, you know, if they were alive today, would say, it's not that you can't have emotions. It's just don't confuse having those emotions with doing something about a problem. Or don't, just because you feel a certain way doesn't mean that you should react emotionally. And that's the distinction, and I think that's where it's much more practical today. It's not, you know, an argument that emotions shouldn't exist. It's saying, like, hey, is this a harmful emotion, or is this a constructive emotion, and I'm going to choose how I act, just as they teach, you know, in cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which is very rooted in Stoic thought as well.
It feels like a very postmodern revelation that the way we perceive things may not actually reflect reality, right? We all have this subjective understanding of things, and yet, am I going too far in saying that it seems that the Stoics had their finger on this a very long time ago?
Yeah, look, and I don't just think it was the Stoics. I mean, you've got Shakespeare. There is no good or bad, but thinking makes it so, right? Or, you know, I quote Laura Ingalls Wilder in the book, like, there's good in everything if only you look for it. I think we know objectively that even at our worst moment, there is probably someone else who would gladly trade places with us, who's much less fortunate. And yet, we are so convinced that our personal situation is bad because it feels bad to us in that moment. And so I think, you know, the ancients were able to be a little bit more objective, but wisdom at its core is about stepping back and seeing things from a distance. And so I think you've seen wise people all throughout history understand it, and it's also common sense, and that's why you've probably heard it from your parents at one point or another as well.
Probably in the form of suck it up, but yes.
Yes.
So you have a great story in the book about Amelia Earhart, who really could have let her pride get in the way, understandably could have let her pride get in the way when she was offered a sort of second banana seat on this transatlantic flight. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, so the story is Amelia Earhart, before she became this world-renowned aviatrix, her first transatlantic flight, the one that made her initially quite famous, she not only was the second choice for, there was a sponsor, she was the second choice, so she was offered it after the first pilot backed out, and then she was unpaid and she was forced to stomach two male chaperones who did most of the flying. Basically, her job was to sit in the back of the plane with the map. And you know, what I say in the book is, like, what do you think she said to this offer? She said yes, right? She said yes because she knew that to make the headway that she needed to make, it wouldn't be continuing her career as a social worker is not getting her any closer to being a great aviator. Sometimes you have to say yes to something. You have to put your foot in the door, and you have to take it. You know, another story that's not in the book, but the great civil rights leader, Booker T. Washington, he got into college by sweeping the admissions room, right? He did whatever it took to get his foot in there, and he was willing to sort of take something that was demeaning or less than what he should have to get him closer to where he needed to go. And I compare that to, like, I'm a millennial, and I left college early, but when I saw my class graduate into the financial recession, I saw them basically make two decisions, which was to either go back to school or to go live with their parents, because the job market wasn't what they wanted to be. And so what I like so much about that Amelia Earhart story is she's saying, like, look, there's what I want it to be, and there's what's good enough for me to get started, and I'm just going to take that, and I'm going to go from there.
And that runs really counter to what's happening, say, in American politics today, where, you know, compromise is a dirty word, and where the idea is that the sort of most honorable people are believed to be those who take a position and refuse to even look in another direction.
Yes. Well, I think there's a couple things there. One, ironically, the Stoics were very much about meeting people where they are. It says, hold yourself to a high standard, let other people behave how they will. And yet, ironically, one of the most famous Stoics was Cato, who challenged Julius Caesar. There's a great biography written by Rob Goodman and Jimmy Soney. Cato was the uncompromising Stoic, and as a result, the principles of the Roman Republic perished because they sort of backed Caesar into this corner. So I think I appreciate the pragmatic side in Stoicism, although there, of course, is the unyielding, uncompromising side. And I guess, you know, obviously readers can choose what they want in their life. But I think this idea of meeting people where they are and never letting, you know, perfect be the enemy of good enough is a philosophy you see in our great politicians, Lincoln being probably the most compelling example.
Well, we'll tell that story in just a couple of minutes. We're going to take a quick break here. My guest is Ryan Holiday. He is editor-at-large for the New York Observer, and he's got a new book out called The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet. I am at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ryan Holiday. He is editor-at-large for the New York Observer, and he has a new book out called The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Ryan, before the break, we were talking about never letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. You mentioned Abraham Lincoln. Can you talk about the ways that he applied stoicism to the challenges he faced in his life, and in particularly in the Civil War?
Sure. So obviously, I think his political philosophy was very much about being willing to make good deals with bad people in pursuit of a larger goal. But the story I tell in the book is one that I think is missed, because we have this image of him as this sort of mythical, you know, figure, and then we also have this idea of him being this sort of jovial, fun, awkward character. And in reality, he was a man, and from what we know of that man, from reports from friends and family and his own writings at the time, is that he suffered from a crippling depression most of his life, what they called then melancholy, but now would be clinical depression, like suicidal depression even. And what his biographers think is that this brooding depression sort of disconnected him from other people for a time, forced him to look very deeply within himself, to sort of understand what suffering really is. And it created this compassion. What we talked about earlier, this idea of apathy. He wasn't a man who got very angry. He wasn't a man who got sort of ripped by the highs and lows of the Civil War. And I think it's what uniquely suited him for that role that America needed at the time, which was this patient, plodding, persistent, compassionate figure who had a monumental task in front of him. That he felt like he was almost destined for, right? Almost that, you know, Christ-like figure as we see now with the assassination, obviously. And so, to me, the story there is that sometimes the darkest, deepest things that we are burdened with by biology or accidents of birth or whatever can actually be sources of great strength for us. They can be training for something in the distant future that we don't know about. But it depends on how we look and what we tell ourselves those experiences mean. You know, Viktor Frankl, the survivor of the Holocaust, he says, part of finding meaning in life is finding meaning in the suffering that you face in life. And I think Lincoln is a profound example of that idea.
And it also helps to have a belief that you are part of something larger than yourself in order to bear profound suffering and find a reason for it.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, as Lincoln grew older, his understanding of slavery became one in which it was this curse that had been visited upon America that he wouldn't have chosen to have to deal with, but it fell on him to address. And, you know, you see this everywhere in his address at Gettysburg, his second inaugural address. It's this idea that he is part of a great cause and a great war. And it fell upon him to dispense of this burden, for better or for worse, as best he knew how.
We forget, too, that whole understanding was a process for Lincoln. He wasn't born knowing that he would have such a great role in defeating slavery in this country, and he wasn't even sure initially that he was willing to sacrifice the cohesiveness of the Union to end it.
Absolutely, and you see him intellectually come to that over time. And I imagine that as a 19-year-old man dealing with depression, or as a 25-year-old man or a 40-year-old man, the depression does not make sense to you at the time. But it's this idea of putting it in perspective. You know, his favorite saying is this idea of "this too shall pass," right? This idea that the experiences, you might not be sure what they mean, but you are going to find meaning for them, and that's what you're searching for. I think that's what Lincoln did.
As you mentioned, Ryan, you are still quite young, but I wonder if, based on your study of this, you feel like stoicism becomes easier as we get older.
I think so. I think, you know, the younger you are, the less times the world has probably humbled you, right? And as you as you grow older and you achieve things and fail at things, this concept becomes clearer over time, certainly. And it, you know, if philosophy is part of your learning experience, the more you read and the more you are exposed to the words of the ancients, the more you can begin to apply what you've read to what you're living, and what you can apply what you're living to what you're reading for the first time.
So there is also this idea that Stoicism can help us make obstacles, put obstacles in a position where they defeat themselves. And a good example of this is Gandhi, who got caught, I guess, intentionally harvesting sea salt. Can you talk about that story and how that plays into all this?
Yeah, I mean, one of the connections I wanted to make in the book was in political or military movements, often a very small enemy somehow manages to defeat a significantly larger enemy who's got all the things that strategists say are important in victory, right? And why is that? And obviously Malcolm Gladwell attempted to address this in David and Goliath as well, but why is sometimes being the David an advantage over the Goliath? And I think it's because, you know, when strength doesn't go against strength, then it doesn't matter how evenly they are matched up. And this is something you learn in the martial arts as well. When you can attack where you are strong and where the enemy is weak, those strengths suddenly become a disadvantage, right? So if you're big or tall, now that creates leverage, right? And it creates opportunities to be thrown off balance. And what you see with Gandhi is Gandhi is outmatched militarily, and obviously his philosophy and religion is such that, you know, violence is not an option, but it also militarily wasn't an option even if he wanted to. And so instead he uses the might of the British Army against itself by forcing them to enforce what were bankrupt, morally bankrupt policies, right? So the idea that collecting salt was illegal, that it was heavily taxed, and you're going to send a man essentially wearing a loincloth to gather it with thousands of unarmed people, and then have to stop that militarily, it puts the opponent in a very untenable position. And he did that over and over again, and you saw Martin Luther King do the same thing in the Civil Rights Movement.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Eddie who says, has another Booker T. Washington story. He says, Booker T. Washington once tried to hail a carriage in D.C. during a rainy night. The driver refused to take him because he was African-American. Undaunted, Washington offered to drive the carriage and let the driver rest inside where it was dry and still pay the fare. The driver agreed and was shocked when Washington pulled up to the White House. Turns out Washington was a top advisor at the time to President Grover Cleveland, the first and for decades only African-American with such direct access and information. He refused to let a personal insult and the personal insult and slight of daily racism stop him. Wow, I have not heard that story before, but it's an amazing one.
I haven't heard it either. I don't know if it's true either. I mean, it sounds wonderful. I do know there's a story that Booker T. Washington told about Frederick Douglass, where they were forced to go to the back of a baggage car in a train, like they were forced to head to the Coloreds Only carriage or whatever. And he apologized to Frederick Douglass, and he said, you know, like, I'm so sorry, this must be very demeaning. And Frederick Douglass's response is, someone else doesn't have the power to demean me. I maintain that myself, which is a very Stoic idea. It's this idea of external events don't define us. Our own actions, our own decisions define us. And I think that's what you see in those strong, empowering messages, like the story that the viewer just told. And the reason I tell them in the book is not to say, like, this is very easy, look at what this person did, but in fact to say, here is what someone did when faced with completely unjustifiable and cruel discrimination and prejudice. Let us think of that the next time we are complaining or struggling with a much more minor issue.
Another major challenge that many people have to cope with is not external, but, you know, with weakness or disability or disease within their own bodies. And Theodore Roosevelt essentially decided not to simply accept the kind of physical limitations he was born with, but to keep pushing about them. And that was really much more about will than any kind of thing he could do to his body.
Yeah, well, what I think is so fascinating about Theodore Roosevelt is that he essentially invented the modern American male, like that archetype. That is Theodore Roosevelt. And yet, when you looked at him when he was 11 years old and nearly dying every night of asthma attacks, you would never have guessed that. And he traced it, and his sister, I think, is where the accounts come from. He traced it to this conversation with his father as a young boy. His father said, "Look, like Theodore, your mind is amazing. You're probably a genius, but the mind cannot go far on its own. A strong mind must be, you know, within a strong body, and you have to make your body as well." And Theodore's response was, "I will make my body." And you can actually visit the house that he did this in. It's on 20th Street in Manhattan. His father built him a home gym, and he quite literally made his body by lifting weights and exercising and worked asthma out of his system. And it was this idea of sort of preparing for the strenuous life that I think is a very stoic concept. You know, it's so easy to be soft and sheltered and insular in our world where technology and prosperity make that possible. But the Stoics had this idea of an inner citadel, having a strong shell that protects you from external events. And I think it's very important.
So sometimes challenges seem too great to be conquered, right? They're just so insurmountable. Can you talk about how Stoicism encourages us to at least power through our doubts so that we can make incremental progress, even if we're not sure we can get to the end?
Yeah, I think what the Stoics talk about is this idea of taking it one step at a time. To borrow, you know, a more modern phrase, it's action by action, step by step, item by item is the way that the Stoics think about it. And this is what the Navy SEALs talk about too, right? It's if you've got to swim 50 meters without a breath, don't think about the 50 meters that you have to swim. Think about each individual stroke. And you break the task down into these component parts, and then you allow yourself exclusively to focus on the most immediate one in front of you, and then the one after that, and the one after that, and you take it as far as you can go. This makes it so much easier than when we are focused on the distant or overwhelming obstacle or future that we have in front of us.
How do Stoics cope with defeat, whether it is permanent or whether it is something that at least seems to be, all we can see at the moment?
Well, the quote that the book is based on, this idea of the impediment to action advance is actually what stands in the way becomes the way, makes it a lot easier to accept failure because you know that failure is temporary, right? You say, okay, I got fired. That's what happened. It's not going to ruin my life because I'm going to do X, Y, and Z now. Or my company went out of business, or the book that I wrote didn't do well, or, you know, whatever it happened, I didn't get into the college that I wanted to get in. And the Stoics are, I think, very much about accepting and then proceeding in spite, or, you know, proceeding again anyway. So there's not this kicking and screaming about the things that we can't change, but it's focused on the part that we can change, which is our response or what we do next or afterwards.
And there are some situations in which, I suppose, you can take a Stoic approach and look in a really different, counterintuitive way at something everybody else sees as a crisis. And the example there is John D. Rockefeller.
Sure, yeah. I open the part one of the book with the story of John D. Rockefeller, who began his financial career shortly before the Panic of 1857, which originated in the state that he lived in. It wrecked the financial industry. And yet he looked back at that period as being the most transformative part of his education. He calls it his sort of apprenticeship in adversity. He said later, you know, "I've always been inclined to see the opportunity in every disaster." And that's what he saw the Panic of 1857 as. It was this chance to learn about the market at its worst, to learn how it worked when people were freaking out, when things were going bad, when there were undervalued opportunities out there. That's what he saw it as. And then when you look, he made so much of his fortune during the Civil War, during the Panic of 1873, 1897, 1907, 1929 even, as a very old man. He saw these crises not as things to be afraid of, but just a different set of circumstances that he could learn from and act on.
And it's funny that in a financial crisis, we all know that the advice is not to let our emotions get the better of us, and that is almost impossible to follow for most people.
Right. That doesn't make it easy or simple to do.
Right.
Or what I say in the book is a lot of this is very simple but not easy,
mm-hmm.
and it takes practice. It takes repeated exposure. It took him being in a financial crisis as a young man and learning from it and going through those 3 years of difficulty until he came out the other side. And then he'd taken something away from that process. So I think that's what you want to think about, and that's what the Stoics would say, and it's something I try to remind myself of constantly. When something bad happens or something that I unexpected or something I'd rather not have happened, at the very least, it's training, right? Or it's exposure to something that's likely going to be a recurring theme in our lives.
How does objectivity play into Stoic ideals?
Well, you know, when we look at things emotionally, or we are looking at things from a lens of fear or frustration, we're not seeing them as they actually are. We're seeing them plus the baggage that we're bringing to the table. So I talk about the samurai swords in Musashi, this idea of the difference between the observing eye and the perceiving eye. The observing eye is objective, and the perceiving eye is telling us what's there. And the simpler you can keep it, the easier it is. And so the Stoics talk about thinking of, you know, sticking with first impressions. So it's, you know, I got fired, and now my life is over. That's two different interpretations. It's what happened plus what you're telling yourself it means. And the Stoics are saying, stick with the first thing. Yes, you don't work there anymore. That's unfortunate. That is a reality. You tell yourself whether it's unfortunate. You tell yourself whether you're never going to recover.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Ryan Holiday. His book is The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ryan Holiday, editor-at-large for the New York Observer and author of the new book, The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Ryan, you were saying before the break that we take whatever happens to us, and we can look at the objective facts of what happens, and then we do have a choice in terms of how we interpret it and what we expect its effect to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, the Stoics were writing before a lot of the breakthroughs that we've had in psychology and neuroscience and such. So their understanding is going to be a little bit more black and white and a little bit more simplistic than I think we understand it now. So, you know, if I get in a car accident tomorrow, I'm going to have an adrenaline dump. I'm going to have a certain, you know, response that's going to be, to some extent, outside of my control. Obviously, with extensive training, perhaps I could be, you know, more prepared for this, but at a certain point, trauma is trauma, and the body takes over. But I think we always retain the ability to delay decisions based on this information. You know, we still retain the ability to learn from the events, to sort of step back and say, okay, I'm feeling this way. Is this really what I want to do? You know, the Stoics aren't saying when someone you know dies, you're not allowed to cry about it and feel sad about it. In fact, there's many very moving essays from the Stoics about grief and love and things like that. But they're saying if a year later you're still crippled with grief, you have to ask yourself, is this what that person would have wanted? Is this how you're going to continue to live your life? Is this a constructive use of your emotions and the limited time that you have here on Earth?
The Stoics ultimately are a lot about no excuses, right? And you tell the story of Demosthenes. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, so Demosthenes, the great Athenian orator, he's born with a terrible speech impediment, maybe some sort of physical disability as well. His wealthy parents die, and his guardians steal all his money, which deprive him of his education. And yet Demosthenes sort of, it's almost like a movie. He decides he is going, he sees this great orator, and he says, I'm going to follow in that guy's footsteps. He literally moves underground to practice, to teach himself the law, to conquer his speech impediment. He does these, you know, Plutarch tells us he spoke with stones in his mouth. He would practice yelling into the wind or giving speeches while running. At one point, he shaves half of his head so he'd be too embarrassed to go outside and would spend all his time studying. And eventually, he ends up challenging them in court and little by little wins his what remains of his inheritance back. But in the process, what he wins is really this intricate knowledge of the law, this powerful voice, this, you know, this dignified persona, and this, you know, intense dislike for injustice that makes him, you know, this great speaker and politician that is echoed down through the ages.
You mentioned earlier that the Stoics were all about holding themselves as individuals to a very high standard and then meeting everybody else wherever they happen to be. I wonder if there is a concern that people who embrace Stoicism today don't extend compassion to other people because they look around and say, well, I challenged myself to do this and I have succeeded and therefore there's no reason you can't.
Well, I would say it's actually the opposite. So, you know, the opening line in Meditations from Marcus Aurelius is very well quoted at this point, but it's you know, today you will meet people and they will be petty and jealous and mean and greedy and bitter, and he lists all these faults that you will see in people. And he says, they are like this because they have not had the training that you have had, and they have not been, you know, availed of the wisdom and virtue that you have been given. So you need to forgive them for this and not take it personally when they act this way. So I think certainly there is some criticism there for a little bit of paternalism, but I think what it is saying is, like, look, you control how you behave. Other people, you don't control how other people behave. And if you go around being angry about it or protesting it, that's not going to get you anywhere either. You've got to meet people where they are. You've got to treat them as well as you can because that's the standard that you hold yourself to, rather than doing it as part of some tit-for-tat exchange.
So talk about what you would recommend to somebody who wants to cultivate these qualities in themselves. Does it start with, first of all, reading the material, but then does it start with journaling?
I think so. I think what it is it's reading availing yourself of this great wisdom that has been created over the many thousands of years. And what's so great about Stoicism is it's not some exclusive religion that you have to buy into. If you read one line from Marcus Aurelius or, you know, that I'm quoting in my book or whatever that helps you manage your perceptions a little bit better and lets you see things more objectively, and that's all you agree with in Stoicism, then that's all that's fantastic. There's a great line from Seneca where he says, like, I don't mind quoting a bad author if the line is good. Hmm. So, like, you know, if you can get something out of Stoicism, then awesome. If you want to sort of fully adopt this way of thinking, then the source material is there. And it's about, you know, taking every chance that you have in life, every situation that you face, and trying to actually apply it. It's not a theoretical exercise. It's an actionable piece of advice to apply to the situations that you face.
Do you think American culture has grown overall less Stoic than it was decades or centuries ago?
Well, I quote Ralph Waldo Emerson, who has, you know, often quoted the Stoics and loved them a great deal, criticizing, you know, the young men of New England for not being Stoic enough in the 1850s. So it's always been a criticism, but I do say that I do think that as we become more successful as a society and as we are more sheltered and sheltered from some of the things that generations before us have had to go through, we can tend to get a little conceited and a little less stoic, and I think that sets you up for, you know, a fall, because you never know how things are going to turn out.
What kind of self-discipline is required to really live a stoic life?
I do think that self-discipline is critical, but it's about applying it where you can, how you can, as often as you can, and understanding that you're going to fail quite often, and have the sort of self-respect and self-love to keep trying despite it. Stoics say, don't go around expecting Plato's Republic. We're not all philosopher kings. We're all just trying to do the best we can with what we've got.
And Stoics also need to, I suppose, as does everybody, to sort of look around and see what needs changing in the world besides simply how they want to achieve their own objectives.
Sure. You know, Marcus Aurelius was, like, the word cosmopolitan comes from Marcus Aurelius. I am a citizen of the world. It's this idea of seeing how you are a very small piece in a very large system or operation. And that can be both humbling and empowering, I think. It's about thinking, you know, I quote James Stockdale, who was Admiral James Stockdale, who was a Stoic imprisoned in prison camps in Vietnam. This idea of unity over self, right? It's about the people that you're in the boat with. And I think that's very important. And sometimes we can solve our own problems by not thinking so selfishly and thinking a little bit more selflessly.
What does it take to open ourselves up to the fact that whatever the solution is might be different than what we initially anticipate? In other words, to be really creative with our way around whatever obstacles we face.
Yeah. I like the metaphor of water is one that strategists love to use. You know, you can't stop water. It always goes around, and it just keeps coming and coming and coming. And I think that's a metaphor to think about. It's not about brute force. It's about persistence and energy and weight over a long period of time.
So I don't mean to call you out on this, except that it is part of your sort of official bio, and you've mentioned it. So can you talk about, like, deciding to leave school and why you didn't decide this was something you wanted to power through and you felt like your path needed to take you in a different direction?
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, I didn't quit school because I wasn't able to do well in it. I went to University of California. I was a scholarship student. I loved college. I loved reading and I loved doing these things. And I got certain opportunities that I felt I couldn't turn down. I became the research assistant for Robert Greene, who wrote the 48 Laws of Power and Mastery, who is a hero of mine. And I'd always wanted to be a writer, and I felt like this was this chance for me to learn a craft. And, you know, it was a very difficult thing to do. It was something that, you know, your parents don't want to see you do. And it wasn't what I'd always expected for myself. But the opportunity came, and I felt like, you know, it's something I wanted to take a risk on. And I, you know, thinking about it like a Stoic, I evaluated what the worst-case scenario was, and it was something I was comfortable with.
Yeah, you point out that in Stoicism there is action, but it's not necessarily action for its own sake. There is a reason behind it, and you have to have sort of control over how you go about things.
Yeah. Like, I knew where I wanted to end up, and I felt like jumping, in so to speak, would get me closer to it. And I knew that, however, it could blow up in my face. It could go wrong. And I was okay with that. I, you know, sometimes we're so afraid of things because we don't actually think about what we're afraid of. And what was I afraid of? I'm not going to starve to death. You know, I can always go back to school. And yes, some people don't agree with my decision, but I can take that as well. And so, you know, Stoicism, I don't talk about myself at all in the book, but Stoicism was something that was there for me in difficult moments, like, you know, being a 20-year-old or a 19-year-old who's leaving college against the explicit wishes of his parents. Like, Stoicism was something that I turned to, and I, countless untold people throughout history have done the same.
Most of the people you, I mean, what percentage of the people that you profile in this book and sort of apply the principles of Stoicism to their actions, were they all familiar with these ideas, or are they, were they sort of received just as wisdom down through the ages, or things that are fundamentally apparent to people who think in deep ways about the world as it works?
Yeah, it's definitely both. And I close the book with the list of people who are explicitly Stoic. You know, Thomas Jefferson dies with Seneca on his nightstand. George Washington was introduced to Stoicism as a young man. He put on a play about Cato at Valley Forge. So there's definitely a direct influence, especially through American history. And, you know, I make that link, but I also say, again, Stoicism is not an explicit philosophy. It's a way of life. It's a way of acting. And so people who are acting that way, whether they know it or not, are an example to the Stoics. So when you read the ancients, they're quoting all sorts of people that would never have seen themselves as philosophers, and I kind of wanted to continue that tradition. But I would say, like, the people who were explicitly Stoic were the minority in the book, but we are all heirs to this tradition in one way or another.
Do the values of Stoicism tend to dry up a little bit when everything's going well? In other words, is it less important when we're not facing obvious barriers?
Sure, I definitely think you see a resurgence of Stoicism through difficult periods in history: the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, American Civil War, American Revolution, what have you. But what the Stoics would say is precisely when things are going well, you should be thinking about what could go wrong so it doesn't catch you by surprise and, you know, perhaps you can prevent it. So I think you see that cycle, whether it's deliberate or not, or in fact a violation of the philosophy in general, I can't say.
Do you think there's any Stoicism in the educational culture of the United States today?
I would hope so. I mean, I think, you know, you may be briefed on one of the Stoics at some time or another when you're learning about Roman history. Do we teach, you know, Paul Tuff has a great book about how children learn. Do we teach them grit, even though it's quite an important virtue and success? Not as much as I think we need to.
It's sort of hard, I suppose, to work that into the curriculum and then test for it with a bubble sheet.
Well, that's the problem. Yeah, you test for things that maybe only the world can test you for.
Ryan Holiday is editor-at-large for the New York Observer and author of the new book, The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph. Ryan, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me. This is quite a conversation.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.